Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of charisma did the French actress Sarah Bernhardt possess that her name is still famous more than a century after the height of her career? Emerging from a heartbreaking childhood with the fierce determination to succeed, Bernhardt worked nearly as hard at burnishing her celebrity status as at her art. It is fair to argue she was the world's first global superstar, a drama queen and diva who was either loved or hated but never ignored. As her biographer Robert Gottlieb has learned, Sarah Bernhardt often and unabashedly shared the gritty details of her life, but true to form never hesitated to punch up those accounts or create them out of whole cloth, the better to entertain her spellbound audience. Robert Gottlieb is dance critic for the New York Observer and has served as editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster, Alfred A. Knopf, and The New Yorker. His new book is called Sarah, The Life of Sarah Bernhardt. Bob, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Hi.
I knew I was in for a treat reading this book when on page one you tell us she was a complete realist when dealing with her own life, but a relentless fabulist when recounting it. Did Sarah Bernhardt expect people to believe everything she told them?
I don't think she much cared. What was interesting to her was a great story, a dramatic story. She didn't lie for advantage. It wasn't that she wanted to get anything out of it. It was just her nature. She responded dramatically and enjoyed fabulating, if that's a word. And people took it with grains of salt. She just had a good time with a good story.
What do we know for certain about how she came into the world?
Well, we know who her mother was. That's a good start. Mm-hmm. Her mother was a very young German, Dutch, Jewish girl who came to Paris very early in her life, in her mid-teens, really, and became a kind of courtesan and remained that. She and her sister, Rosine, were both courtesans. And Sarah had a father, but no one quite knows who he was. There are many ideas, and she had ideas. But basically, she grew up fatherless and with a mother who, it turned out, didn't really care for her very much. So she had two strikes against her from the start.
And that must have been a particular blow, given that her mother does seem to have cared a lot about her two younger sisters.
She did, particularly the middle sister. The mother made it very plain. She would say to people, oh, I do love Sarah, you know. I almost love her as much as her sister. That was not amusing for this very sensitive and tumultuous child.
Later in her life, she would write a novel. And what does that reveal, do you think, about the things that she longed for as a little girl?
Well, it's sort of very, very sad. Very late in her life, she took to writing some fictions that were serialized in Paris newspapers because anything that she said, did, or wrote was of interest to the French. And she wrote a book in which the heroine is a young girl, beautiful, talented, who becomes overnight a huge star, which Sarah did not, and who had parents who adored her, worshipped her, sacrificed for her, did everything for her. In other words, this late-in-life novel was an act of wish fulfillment on Sarah's part. It being a pathetic thing to have happened for a woman who at this point was probably the most famous woman in the world.
She spent most of her childhood then far away from family, first in a sort of foster care situation where her mother wasn't even quite sure where she was, and then later in boarding schools and convent schools. And she wouldn't have been remembered as a great student, but she was already an unforgettable personality at that time.
She was. She dominated everything through her dramatic presentation of herself, her determination, her charm. In her schools, she didn't do very well, as you say, but when she was in the convent school, she believes that the Mother Superior thought she was special and wonderful, despite the fact that she was born Jewish. Her mother was Jewish, so that she needed to be converted to Catholicism and was indeed confirmed.
What's so interesting about that is that this was a time when anti-Semitism was rampant and people had no problem speaking it aloud. Even though she converted to Catholicism, she never seemed ashamed of her Judaism and, in fact, was very proud of it.
She was indeed. She loved to refer to the sacred blood of Israel that coursed through her veins. But she encountered a lot of anti-Semitism on her Russia tours, on German tours, and particularly in Montreal. She's played a number of times in Canada, where the Archbishop did not like her performing in plays that, for instance, did not look happily at the Inquisition, and she was attacked by mobs. I mean, she wasn't harmed, but they pelted her carriage with rocks. They called out unpleasant things. It was not good, but she defied everybody, as she did her entire life. And her politics were vague. She, of course, always was friendly with anyone who was on the top, starting with the Emperor Louis Napoleon, and on through the various people who ran France during her lifetime. The one time that she emerged as an important figure or semi-important figure was during the famous Dreyfus case, the Dreyfus affair, in which her great friend Émile Zola wrote his famous attack called J'accuse, and Sarah was there by his side, either actually, as she claimed, or figuratively, and she herself then became in the line of fire from the anti-Semitic press, who was so anti-Dreyfusard.
And this was the one time that she really came into a serious conflict with her son.
The only time. Her son was the most important person in her life from start to finish. He was born when she was 20, and his father, like her father, remained something of a mystery. But she worshipped him, adored him, coddled him, paid for him his entire life, and raised him to be a kind of Catholic aristocrat. His job was to learn fencing, to learn dancing, to learn gambling. That was not a hard thing for him to do. She once said that the only thing she expected from Maurice, her son, was that he dress well. But during the lifetime, they lived near each other, if not with each other. His wives were both subsidiary to her in his imagination and his affections, except when the Dreyfus case hit. And then, since she had raised him to be, as I say, a right-wing, conservative, aristocratic member of the Jockey Club, he was very violently pro-army and anti-Dreyfus, whereas she was even more vehemently on the other side. And the quarrels became so terrible, so severe, that he actually left Paris for a year with his wife and his little girls and didn't speak to her for a year.
Being so proud herself of her Jewish blood, why do you think she didn't encourage her son to embrace that?
Because the decision had been made early on when she was a girl that she would officially be a Catholic and lead that life. She was never very serious about it, but she did all the appropriate things. And his supposed father was a Belgian prince, the Prince de Ligne, who took it all seriously, presumably. So that was what she wanted for him. She wanted him to be as upper class as was possible, which meant as Catholic and as right-wing as possible.
It is funny to think that when she was in that convent school, she did talk seriously for a short time about becoming a nun.
Oh, yes.
Because
always self-dramatizing, you know. And she threw herself into everything. If she was going to be a Catholic, she was going to go all the way. Until it was totally clear that she had absolutely none of the qualities that a nun would require.
Her penchant for drama started when she was very young. She was of a delicate constitution, and it seems like every time she had a tantrum, she literally made herself deathly ill.
She did, and she clung to her bed, and she's always writing in her memoirs, you know, she hovered near death for days, they feared for her, my life, etc., etc. The moment she came into her powers, the moment she took charge of her own life after she was a successful actor and when she broke with the Comédie Française, whose greatest star she was, and took charge of her theatrical career, her health became incredibly strong. All those tubercular leanings that she had seemed to vanish, and she sort of became psychosomatically healthy. Later in her life, of course, she had difficulties, uremia, which she eventually died, and the terrible disaster of her knee, which resulted in 1915 in her being amputated.
She essentially, this goes back to her pragmatism, she realized she couldn't live with the pain and asked for the amputation. This was not a gangrene situation.
She decided that she couldn't deal with it anymore. The pain was just too great, and she'd rather die. So she decided that she would have it cut off. And when her son Maurice heard this, he was distraught and couldn't bear the thought that his mother would have an amputation. So she looked at him coolly and said, very practically, as you suggest, she said, all right, look, here are the choices. I have my leg off, or I kill myself. You decide. It's up to you. I'll go either way. Whereupon, of course, he broke down in tears and said, go ahead with it. And she did gaily and cheerily, sending off telegrams to friends saying, you know, book me some lectures for the spring. And of course, she survived.
Robert Gottlieb is my guest. He is dance critic for the New York Observer and former editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster, Alfred A. Knopf, and The New Yorker. His new book is called Sarah, The Life of Sarah Bernhardt. We'll resume this conversation with Robert Gottlieb in just a few minutes. This is one of our favorite shows, and we are bringing it to you now because we are in the fundraising campaign. We hope this will remind you, if you needed reminding, of how much you like this show, of how much you count on it to expose you to new books you want to read, new ideas you want to pursue, new things you want to understand. The number to call to make a contribution is 1-888-694-6931, or you can always go online to kera.org, and you can receive a copy of Sarah Bernhardt, or Sarah, The Life of Sarah Bernhardt.
That's right. She's Chris Boyd. I'm Jeff Whittington, and we are able to offer you your very own copy of Robert Gottlieb's really well-received book. Actually, at the time that he was on the show last fall, I think they were already into their second or third printing, and the book had just come out a few months before. So it was a really well-received, very highly praised book. And, of course, he's fantastic. I mean, he's sort of a legendary editor. And it was really, really great to get him on the show. So we're really thrilled to be able to bring you this program again today. And if you're enjoying it, as we are, then we hope that you'll be moved to call 888-694-6931. To go online to kera.org. You don't have to be dramatic about it. you don't have to be Sarah Bernhardt.
No need to amputate anything.
Or swoon, for that matter. But I always think of swooning when I think of Sarah Bernhardt for some reason. You just have to call. You just have to go online. It takes a couple of minutes. And really, just for a few dollars a month, you can become a listener who supports the station rather than someone who just listens. Well, you don't want to just be anything. You never want to say, well, I'm just a listener. I really love the content, but I'm just a listener. I don't give money.
Everybody else who gives money would probably also consider themselves just a listener, but a listener who recognizes that you have to take action for the things that you think are important. You know, there are so many things in the world that we think somebody ought to do something about that. With public radio, somebody did. People decided to start sending money and start supporting the station. KERA has grown over the years, provided you more and more services, including a whole bevy of things online and on different digital media. That's all thanks to your financial participation at kera.org and at 1-888-694-6931.
Yeah, but I don't want to give because everything they do doesn't reflect my worldview.
Well, that's exactly the point.
We are not
here to tell you what to think. We're not here to cater to any one certain kind of person. We're here to we're here to cater to people who are interested in learning, who are curious about the world, and who want to experience things that they don't otherwise in their regular
life. And who are comfortable maybe being pushed a little bit. And you know what? That's why you listen. You're that person. That's why you listen right now. So we're just asking you to support that station. That caters to you. You know, any station that espoused the beliefs of any one person would be that person would be the only listener. And maybe they wouldn't even support it. They may not like what they heard. So do your part today to support a station that does cater to you because you like challenging conversations and ideas and smart and intelligent radio. Call 888-694-6931 or contribute at kera.org.
Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert Gottlieb. We're talking about his new book, Sarah, The Life of Sarah Bernhardt. We should say here, Bob, that although we think of Sarah Bernhardt being very dramatic and over the top and showy, she also had a pretty amazing sense of humor. And since we were talking right before the break about her leg amputation later in life, can you tell the story of what happened when, according to legend, P.T. Barnum offered her $10,000 to showcase her leg?
Well, she asked which one. if it was a question of the amputated one, she wasn't really interested. If it was a question of the live one, they should get in touch with their agents.
So was that a joke?
Of course.
Yeah. And she didn't ever have a wooden leg, right?
No, she rejected the idea totally. There was an old story that she used to stomp around on the stage with a wooden leg. No, she hated the idea, and she had a litter constructed, a white litter, and she was carried around in it. And deposited on different pieces of furniture while the curtain was down so that she could be discovered lounging around on a sofa as Cleopatra or whatever the role was.
She was really quite open in terms of her sexual relationships and her sex life. She didn't display any sort of... I guess the mores of the day were not of a concern for her.
That's putting it mildly. well, her mother was a courtesan,
yeah.
And she grew up in a world, although she was partly in the convent, the other part of her life was high life among rich and rowdy people. She didn't want to marry. Her mother wanted her to marry some bourgeois businessman. She wouldn't have none of that. They didn't know what to do with her. She was so tempestuous. She was so sulky. She was a typical adolescent girl, except more so, because everything Sarah did was more so than anyone else did. And finally, her mother's lover, or her aunt's lover, or both of their lovers, the Duke de Morny, who was the illegitimate half-brother of the emperor, said, you know, send her to the conservatory. Let her be an actress. According to her, that had never occurred to her. Who knows? So she did, and she was at the conservatory and went into the Comédie Française and didn't work at first. It took her quite a while to be a success on the Paris stage, but when she was it. The biggest name, the most scandalous, not just for her love affairs, although they were rampant, but also because of her activities, like going up in a balloon drifting out over Paris.
And landing in this farm field, right?
Yeah, and in the rain, and everybody was worried, but she never got worried. She was never worried. Meanwhile, the head of the Comédie Française was furious because he thought he had the right to prevent his actors from leaving Paris without his permission. But she trumped his ace because the Comédie Française needed her more than they needed him.
And she got off to an inauspicious start there.
She did. They didn't know what to do with her. They didn't know what they had there. And she got into a fierce fight because her younger half-sister, Regine, was backstage with her and inadvertently stepped on the costume of a famous old lady actress who slapped her and smacked her into a marble pillar, whereupon Sarah smacked her in the face and refused to apologize and refused to have anything more, and just walked out. She left and drifted for a while and eventually found her way and became the great dramatic star that she was.
I think it's interesting, Bob, that she seems to have cared very deeply for her sisters despite what must have been a tension based on the fact that her mother loved them more than her.
Oh, she was a family person from start to last. She adored and worshipped her mother. She loved, of course, as I said before, her son. She cared for her sisters, both of whom predeceased her. In fact, one of the most famous stories about Sarah and one of the most famous facts about her, which was that she liked to sleep in a coffin, has to do with her sister who was dying of tuberculosis after a very difficult and tawdry existence. Sarah had installed her in her own big bed in her bedroom, and there was no room for another bed. So in order to be with Regine during these terrible nights of coughing and sweating and fever, she had the coffin placed next to the bed so she could lie in it and be with her sister. And at some point, her story is, a manicurist arrived and saw her lying asleep in the coffin and started to scream that she was dead. And immediately, photographers arrived. You can imagine how planned this must have been, but they didn't seem to know it at the time. And the image of her lying in the coffin with flowers at her breast is one of the dominant images of her iconography, and it's huge, by the way, the iconography.
Was it customary at the time to pre-order a coffin for someone who was clearly on their way out?
No, it was her own coffin. She just liked carrying it around with her. She took it on all her tours. And one of the stories about it is that a group of rich and important men sort of all clubbed together to take care of her, whatever that means, and they shared her favors, and they all got on extremely well. She once said, you know, that if she were to die, they'd go right on meeting and having a good time. They say that one of the things they did for her was to buy her this satin-lined coffin.
Well, she wasn't above faking a little tuberculosis when it suited her.
Oh, no. She would apparently say, oh, I'm bleeding, and she would prick her gums so that there would be blood that she could then make look as if it was coming out of her throat.
And that way they'd give her a little more money.
A little more money, another jewel, another hat, another piece of furniture. Who cares what? She didn't care. You know, she made unbelievably huge sums of money, and she lost them. She didn't care. She'd spend everything she had. Then she'd go bankrupt and sell everything. Then she'd make another fortune. She'd go off on tour in her most famous role, the Lady of the Camellias, Camille. And she'd make more millions of francs, and then she'd spend those. And, of course, a lot of it went for Maurice's gambling debts.
Talk about what she looked like. I have to say, the book is, there's dozens of photographs in here. She loved to have her picture taken. What was her look exactly?
She was, first of all, tiny, which you never can tell from the iconography, because she presented herself as tall and in command of space. She had wonderful reddish hair that hung down at the start on her shoulders when she was photographed by the most famous photographer of the time, Nadar. She had eyes that seemed to change in color at her will. Well, everything was at her will. That's what she had, was will. And her face was highly mobile. She had a prominent nose, but it wasn't that terrible thing known as the Jewish nose, the caricatures of Jewishness. It was just very beautiful. She was very, very beautiful and very distinctive. Nobody looked like her, and she dressed to match. She set fashions. She was a prime symbol of Art Nouveau. She sat in a spiral, as it were, like Art Nouveau paintings. She had the most famous craftsmen make her jewels and her props for the stage. She wore things like a hat with a stuffed bat on top of it, her famous bat hat.
It's amazing to look at those Nadar photographs, because they're certainly classical, and yet they look so modern. They were taken in the 1860s.
She does look modern, and the actresses of her day really didn't. She was, ironically, in her young period as an actress, she was considered a major naturalistic actress, as opposed to the highly stylized acting of the Comédie Française. When decades and decades went by, toward the latter part of her career, she was the one who was seen as stylized, and younger actresses, like the famous Eleonora Duse, were seen as the advance guard of naturalism. But that's what happens when you survive that long.
And as she's pioneering this style, critics either absolutely were floored by it and loved it, or thought it was entirely inappropriate.
Well, early on, everyone was in love with her voice and her enunciation of poetry, because when she was at the Comédie Française, she was primarily acting in the great classics by Racine. So it was vital how she spoke the poetry of Racine, of Victor Hugo, etc. And that is what first made her so famous, the beauty of her voice and the beauty of her enunciation of verse.
I would never have thought to look for this on YouTube had I not read your book, but in fact, you can see little short clips of her film work late in her life.
Yeah, she came to film, of course, very late in her life, and she never really adapted to it, and she knew it. She knew it was not for her, because she, by that time, had a highly pronounced, stylized and gestural kind of acting, and she couldn't modulate it for what the camera needed. However, she made a number of films. She was really the first international film star, and she's there in Hollywood's Walk of Stars. There's a tiny clip taken in 1900, before movies really had got going, at the Paris International Fair, in which she's playing her famous Hamlet in the duel scene with Laertes. And she's remarkably good. She's agile. She's virile. That was her view of Hamlet. He wasn't a softy. He wasn't sitting around brooding. He was a young Elizabethan nobleman, prince. And once he got the idea that he had to do away with his uncle and that his uncle was really guilty of killing his father, he just went for it. Well, Sarah went for everything. I mean, it was an expression of her as much as of Shakespeare.
Robert Gottlieb is my guest. He's dance critic for the New York Observer and former editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster, Alfred A. Knopf, and The New Yorker. His new book is called Sarah, The Life of Sarah Bernhardt. We'll resume our conversation with Robert in a few minutes. If you would like to receive a copy of Sarah, The Life of Sarah Bernhardt, we have it available today as a thank you when you join the station at or above the $120 level. Of course, you can do this in an incredibly affordable way if you decide to do a sustaining membership at $10 or $15 or $20 a month. You can make a really substantial contribution and not have it feel like much is coming out of your budget. You can set this all up online at kera.org, or you can call 1-888-694-6931. The senior producer of Think and host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know, Jeff Whittington, is back now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And yeah, you know, maybe you set up a sustaining membership last year and you decided that $5 a month was right for your budget. And so that's a $60 annual contribution. Maybe you want to make it $6 a month. Makes a difference. Or maybe you want to make it $10 a month and take advantage of the offer of the copy of Sarah, The Life of Sarah Bernhardt by Robert Gottlieb. You can do that. Just call 888-694-6931 and just renew your sustaining membership at a little bit higher level. And it's still just as affordable as it was when you started it last year. Maybe you joined the station and made a one-time contribution on a credit card last year, and it's time for you to renew your membership at whatever level it was before. Maybe you gave $100 last year or $200 last year. Well, we'd love to hear from you today with that renewal. Maybe you joined as a Friends member last year at the $1,500 membership level.
We love to have friends join during this show.
Absolutely. And maybe it's time for you to renew that membership. Well, you know what? We heard from a couple of friends yesterday. Don't know if they were new friends or renewals, but you know what? We would love to hear from you if it's time for you to renew your Friends membership today, or if you've decided that you've heard so many great authors on this show, you've gotten so many great reading suggestions, that it's time for you to support the station at a higher level. Well, we'd love to have you on board at that $1,500 Friends level. And remember, that's just $125 a month when you become a sustaining member at the Friends level.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org. We really think of you as part of KERA because you are members of our audience. We really consider that we are working for you, with you. We are listening to you about what you want to hear. Your support sort of completes your place on the team. You know, we know that some of you can afford to give just a little bit of money. Some of you can afford to give what to us is a very substantial amount of money. That decision is up to you, and we would never, say that we know exactly how much your contribution should be. But you know you can afford it, and you know what you can afford. And you know that the station will put your money to work producing and broadcasting programming that you value because you listen to us all the time. When you go online to kera.org or call 1-888-694-6931, really what you're doing is just taking responsibility for the content that you've been consuming.
And maybe you listen to the podcast. Maybe you listen online, or maybe you go and pick up the Think podcast and listen to it later. Well, you know, the podcast has a cost as well because we have to have a production room that we can utilize to get it edited and posted. We have to be able to have access to a high-speed internet line to get the files up. And then, you know, we have to host it online. NPR helps us a little bit with that as well. But if you download the podcast, we offer it to you absolutely free. These programs are archived for about 5 days, 6 days. The last 10 shows are always free online for you to download or for you to subscribe to. And we had over 80,000 downloads of the podcast in December. We could have put a sort of POS sort of application on that and offered that for $1 a podcast, and that would have been over $80,000 for the station. And you know that's a lot of money for this station. But no, we put it out there just like the content on air. It's there for you to use because it's so important that everybody have access to public broadcasting, to news and information and the entertainment that public broadcasting provides. We just hope that those of you who can afford to help pay for the costs of bringing you all this great content absolutely, effortlessly on your part and free for you and everyone else, we hope that you'll do your part to help pay some of the bills. And maybe that means for you a $200 contribution when you call 888-694-6931. Maybe that means for you a $100 contribution when you go online to KERA.org.
You would never walk into a restaurant and enjoy a delicious meal and then point to 8 people and say, hey, why don't you guys all chip in $5 for my meal? I had a great time. I loved it. I'm going to come back to this restaurant tomorrow, as a matter of fact. But today, I don't feel like paying. So all of you can contribute and pay for me. You wouldn't do that. So why would you expect everyone else to pay for your public radio habit? You know, you love public radio. You just have to pay your share. Now, a lot of you do think about, you know, those college kids and those people who are maybe struggling economically right now and kick it a little money to sort of represent their share. But the point is, everyone who listens that has, you know, the financial means to do so, we ask to make a contribution. And it's within almost everyone's financial means, because you can make a contribution of thousands of dollars. You can make a contribution of hundreds of dollars, tens of dollars. You can make a contribution of $10 if you want to. Your contribution, though, goes right to work creating the programming that you love.
Almost every drive, we hear from someone who says, you know, when I was in college and couldn't afford to support the station, I always said that I would when I got out there and got on my own and was making a living. Well, if you're at that place now, if you said that when you were in college, well, you know what? We'd love to hear from you today. It's up to you to decide, but today could be the day that you do your part. Call 888-694-6931. Or go online to KERA.org and make your safe and secure contribution there. It just takes a couple of minutes, and you really will be glad that you did your part. When you tune to KERA, you'll know that your contribution, your dollars, helped make this station possible. Again, 888-694-6931, or do it online at KERA.org. Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
Listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert Gottlieb. We're talking about his new book, Sarah, The Life of Sarah Bernhardt. Bob, I want to go back to this idea of her playing Hamlet in 1900. At this point, she is in her mid-50s. She's a French Jew playing a Danish prince who's supposed to be about 30. The audacity of that is so delightful, and yet she pulled it off.
Well, she pulled everything off, and she always liked playing men's roles, what they used to call trouser roles. She said it wasn't that she liked men in that way. It was that she liked men's minds. So she played men almost from the start, most famously after Hamlet, perhaps. When she was 56, she starred in one of her greatest triumphs called L'Aiglon, which was the name given to Napoleon's late teenage son, who dies tragically of illness. And she, that was no problem for her. The pictures aren't that convincing as L'Aiglon, but she was convincing, and she had maybe the greatest success of her life in that role in its first months of being performed.
It's also pretty remarkable that her star did not seem to fade at all as she aged. Is that a reflection of the fact that people weren't as ageist then as they are now? The entertainment business was not based on close-ups and whether or not you had crow's feet?
Well, that's probably partly it. The thing is that by the time she was 50, let's say 45, 50, she was so famous that people simply wanted to be in her presence. Not that she didn't have some flops, because she did. because she'd play almost anything if she thought it was dramatic. That was what she looked for. But the roles, other than the few classic roles like Phèdre that she kept performing, the roles were very melodramatic. And she was, of course, a mistress of makeup and of clothes, and she knew how to present herself, and the voice was always wonderful. So she could go on playing, for instance, The Lady of the Camellias, which she performed 3,000 times around the world, and people went to see it the way they would go to see a monument, and they would bring their children and their grandchildren. I have seen Sarah Bernhardt in The Lady of the Camellias was something that people needed to say. And even toward the end, when her powers had really diminished, she was still treated as if she was a very great artist and a very, very important person.
I was surprised to read that she had a lifelong issue with stage fright.
She did. It's very remarkable, isn't it? I don't understand it either, but it is the case. And there are other people like that today. There are certain actors or actresses who find it very hard to go on stage, dancers too. Others never think twice about it.
She was also a pretty decent sculptor. Can you talk about her work there?
Yeah. Well, she got bored when she was at the Comédie Française. She didn't have all the roles she wanted. She didn't like the restrictions. So she took up various other things, and sculpting was the most important one. She studied hard, and she exhibited for decades at the major shows and sold her work. When she first went to London, there was a big exhibition. And people like the Prime Minister Gladstone came and talked and bought work. She worked hard at it.
There's a wonderful photograph in the book where she's standing next to a sculpture that she's made, and she's wearing a white silk pantsuit. And again, it looks so modern. It could have been, you know, 50 years ago.
And it was modern because women did not appear that way in public. Interestingly enough, by the way, that studio that she took later became Picasso's studio.
She dabbled at painting, and she wasn't so good at that.
Not so good at that.
Did she think of this visual art as a hobby or as an extension of her performing career?
You know, my view is that her energy was so huge that she needed constant outlets for it. It wasn't enough that she rehearsed all day, directed her plays, saw to every detail, performed eight in her suite in her theater, because eventually she had her own huge theater, the Theatres Sarah Bernhardt, listened to playwrights reading their plays. She needed other things to do, too. So sculpting was certainly one of them.
If she had been born in 1960, would she be an actress today, or would she be running a corporation?
I think she would have been an actress. Her need to project her temperament and personality to others in public, I think, would have overwhelmed every other ability that she might have developed.
Given that you couldn't fully trust the way she accounted for her life in the books that she wrote, how were you able to take that and knit it together with things that other people said about her and figure out what you thought must be the truth?
Well, that's the job of every biographer.
Mm-hmm.
We have the advantage in her case that she did write her memoirs up to a certain age. We have the disadvantage that in those memoirs, there's a lot of truth, but there's obviously a great deal of elaboration. For instance, she tells a story of when she makes her first American tour. She's on a ship to New York, and it's very rough and stormy, and everything is dangerous. And she's up on the deck, of course, and a lady stumbles and almost falls down fatal flight of stairs, but Sarah catches her and saves her life. And this woman says, "Who are you?" And she says, "I'm Sarah Bernhardt." And the woman says, "Oh, no, you're an actress. I am the widow of President Abraham Lincoln. And it was an actor who killed my beloved husband. And now it's an actress who has kept me from joining him in the hereafter." Well, believe this story? She probably, you know, helped some elderly lady from stumbling. And it turns out later that indeed Mrs. Lincoln was on that ship, but there's no talk of any connection or meeting. But it was a great story, so hey, go for it.
She gave these wonderful parties and loved to entertain. Do you think her guests sort of viewed her with the same amusement and affection that we're thinking about her today?
I think so. You know, as she grew older, one of the things that made me happy about writing this book is that she was a difficult child. She was a difficult adolescent. She was very provocative and difficult as a young woman. But she grows. She evolves as a woman and as a person. You feel that she grew into her true self, and that it was a generous self and a resolved self and a happy self, a buoyant self. She didn't go around being actressy. She loved being at home. She had this little place on an island off Brittany. There was never talk of the theater. She tried to play games. She fished. She did this. She entertained her friends. She was a resolved person, and I really came to care for her.
We have an email here from Kay in Dallas who asks, would you speculate on what made it possible for Sarah to mesmerize American audiences during her tours, despite the fact that she performed exclusively in French?
Well, it started off with the publicity. Mm-hmm. Long before she reached America, the publicity was huge, not only about her great art, but about her scandalous life, the illegitimate child. And this was a very puritanical America. So they accused her or named her as everything. Wherever she went, she was the subject or object of incredible curiosity, of weird questions, of almost persecution from journalists, etc. But she carried it all before her. So they were prepared to see an extraordinary person, and I think were surprised to find such a eloquent actress. But, you know, she was not the first. There was already something of a tradition of great European artists turning up, including her famous predecessor, Rachelle, who had had a successful American tour perhaps 25 years earlier.
Did she die with any regrets, do you think?
Well, I can't imagine what they would have been, except that she couldn't be on stage. You know, that's where she was most alive and where she was happiest, preparing to be on stage and being on stage. And she was working up to the last moment, just about.
Is her balloon book still in print?
Well, it's available. She wrote a hilarious account of going up in this balloon, as told by a straw chair that was put in the balloon for her to sit on. But I don't think it's available except from the book organs, book engines that you can get almost anything from.
Robert Gottlieb is dance critic for the New York Observer and has served as editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster, Alfred A. Knopf, and the New Yorker. His new book is called Sarah, The Life of Sarah Bernhardt. Bob, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
Great conversation with Robert Gottlieb. Such an interesting book that it was based on, called Sarah, The Life of Sarah Bernhardt. We do have copies available if you're ready to support KERA this afternoon at or above the $120 contribution level. You can do that at kera.org, or if you prefer, you can call 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is back now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. We've heard from several of you this hour and the last hour of Think, and that's great. If you've still kind of got the slow-mo kind of thing going, if your office is closed or maybe you've still got the kids home from school.
You need to feel like you're getting something done. This
exactly.
is perfect.
And you've been listening, maybe you've been listening a little more over the last couple of days, listening to the campaign, thinking about joining the station. Well, come on and join the station. It's so easy to do when you call 888-694-6931. There's a person who you'll talk to or walk you through the easy membership process. They'll get your personal information, your name, address, phone number, credit card you want to use, how much you want to give to the station. And then you can decide if you want a thank you gift or not. The book by Robert Gottlieb is available at the $120 membership level. You can do it all yourself online if you want to by going to kera.org and going to the support page, and you fill out the membership form yourself. You hit submit, and it's all taken care of in about 2 minutes.
Thank you so much, Krista Tartone and Alan Nugent in Dallas, Adam Strittmatter in Dallas, Lynn and Mark Friedman in Dallas. Really appreciate your participation. Thanks also to Jeff Whitmire in Pilot Point and Carl Kuntz in Bellingham, Washington. Cool. Perhaps a podcast listener or an online listener?
Perhaps so, yeah. We are very excited to hear from you in Bellingham. From what I understand, the weather's a little bit better than it is down here these days. We're thrilled to hear from all of you at from wherever you listen, whatever level, however, whatever method of making your contribution. It all adds up, and it's so important that we hear from you. If you've been considering joining the station, if you use the station, well, I hope you've been considering joining the station, because this is how we make the money that's necessary to pay the bills here. So when we get that heating bill, next month here at KERA, you know, we're going to have to pay that in order to obviously keep the utilities on, just like everybody does. And it would really be helpful if we had heard from you during this membership campaign. 888-694-6931 or online at KERA.org.
Really appreciate Elizabeth and Joe Brugger in Dallas, Melissa Gaddick in Euless, and Robert Mullins in Dallas. By the way, we always appreciate your benevolence when we accidentally mispronounce your names. And I know you all understand that we don't have pronouncers usually. And so if we get it wrong, please know that it's in the right spirit. And I, in the past, have had a last name that was very difficult to say out loud, so I get it.
Yeah, it's a
rather I'm giving myself a pass, meaning I understand that it's
Chris,
mildly annoying.
You can have the pass.
All right. Thanks.
I think people who was it that let's see, last week on the Anything Show, I read somebody's name and said Peggy, but it was actually Perry, and I'm going to make sure I correct that tomorrow. But because he actually knows someone here at the station and said he said my name was Peggy. so you know, sometimes it gets frantic down in the phone room, and which is great.
We love frantic.
Yeah, frantic is great. And so we get, you know, we're looking at about it's like a 7-Eleven security monitor.
It's from like 1973. It's hilarious.
So great.
It's cubical. It is not like a flat screen monitor that we have this information. And it serves our purposes. We're not complaining here, but it is, you know, sometimes you'll see someone's hand go in front of it to give you like a thumbs up sign or
something.
It's
a black and white Ikigami monitor. Closed circuit.
Still has like the V-hold knobs.
It's got knobs on it, and we read your names that have been handwritten by someone off the screen, and that's why Carlos Branger in Dallas. That's why I can say thanks to Kelly Atkins in Dallas. Thanks, Carlos
Akins.
Yeah, that's why I can say thanks to Carter Johnson in Fort Worth and James Murillo in Mesquite, because I can see it on this really cool monitor.
Well, the truth is it still works. And around here, you know, we being careful with your money is important to us. We do have some new technology as well. We have, you know, computers that work, and we make the podcast and everything.
I was issued a new pen, though, during the last membership campaign.
Really? What did you do?
I said on the air, I haven't seen a new pen
when,
around here.
Is that when our CFO came up to you?
There was a pen with a note taped to it on my desk that said, never been used. So we do really run it close to the ground.
We do.
Here,
honestly, most of us who work here really take pride in trying to keep expenses down. You know, we're often, it's suggested that we do so, but we, you know, it's important. And honestly, we donate our own money back to the station. We're not required to, but I don't like to see Jeff running around with 10 pens that he doesn't need. One pen is enough for you. We're careful with the money. We're careful with your money.
She makes me reuse staples, too.
No, I don't make you reuse staples, but that we do write on the back of paper all the time, and we do like to turn off the lights.
Could you imagine? Yes, we do. We do like to turn off the lights here at KERA when a room is not in use. So trust that we're going to use your contribution wisely. That's what we're getting at here, is that, you know, we're not, you know, driving company Cadillacs or anything.
One of these days we'll describe our company cars, but that's really not necessary right now. But they're not Cadillacs.
You can do your part by calling 888-694-6931. You can do your part online at KERA.org. The vehicles that the station has
that's
for reporters to use, yes, those are ones like a 1989 Ford
station wagon,
yeah. Right? And the
it's
other
red.
One. Yeah, it's a red Focus station wagon or something. And the other one's like a 1993 Honda CRV.
And everybody wants the CRV. People are fighting over, like, if the CRV is gone, people are like, oh.
But it works, you know?
It works fine. And you know, it's all part of our focus is really on providing programming.
That's
and
right.
We take pride in that. None of this is a complaint because we're all fine with it. But it's to let you know that we try to avoid the frills so that all of the extra money will go into the programming that you are really supporting. You don't care about our vehicles, but you do care about being able to hear this show and anything you ever wanted to know and all the other programs that are here for you week in and week out.
That's right. And if you want to, and whoever's got the CRV today, it's fine. I left my Quiet Riot cassette tape in the cassette deck. I hope you enjoy it.
Well, we upgraded from the 8-track, which is nice.
Call 888-694-6931 or contribute at KERA.org in support of 90.1 KERA, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. Of course, streaming online all the time at KERA.org, where you find a wealth of news and information. You find the Think Podcast on there for free every single day. So please do your part to support the station because you love it. You'd listen to it. You'd miss it if it was gone. And it's listener-supported public radio.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go to kera.org. We were speaking the last hour with Robert Gottlieb, the incredibly talented editor and also the author of Sarah, The Life of Sarah Bernhardt. If that conversation piqued your interest to read the book and you're also ready to make your contribution to KERA, you can do both right now by going online to kera.org or calling 1-888-694-6931. Make a contribution at or above $120, and we'll send that to you as your thank you gift. Thank you so much for your support.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.